Hi there, it's Nick here. Thanks so much for listening. Not long now until the beginning of the American Triple Crown. The 150th Run for the Roses is just round the corner. As such, this is the sort of time of year where if you are not in the United States, you will be taking a keener interest in matters stateside, as we will be. As such, I would point you towards the racing app. Truly excellent for American cards, form, and one click through to free video pass performances. You don't need bookmaker signups or anything like that. You can just go to the racing app and access all that American racing and video PPs completely free of charge. Now's your time to do it. The racing app.
You're listening to Nick Luck Daily. This edition is brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis. By the Racehorse Owners Association. And by the Racing App, in partnership with FitzDares.
Good morning, welcome to the show. Tuesday, April the 23rd. Overcast morning here in TW11, and indeed some showers forecast for the end of this week. Just in time, I think, for the Bet365 Gold Cup at Sandown Park. More of which later in the show. I'll be speaking to Anthony Bromley, racing manager to owners Simon Munier and Isaac Swed, about El Fabiolo, James Duberle and Ampere A Pass, at least two of whom may well turn up at Sandown for that celebration meeting on Saturday. Also plans for Punchestown and what he's been up to at the Breeze Up sales. Plus, we've got a report from Maddie Playoff from Hong Kong, which is where I am headed later this morning. And, of course, our traditional trip around the bloodstock world with our friends at Weatherby's. But first of all, an interesting story emerging from France involving the multiple champion jockey in France, James Reveley. British born, of course, and that is proving to be something of a thorn in his side. As we found out yesterday in an interview that then swept through the French media and could have quite serious positive impact for him and for fellow expat riders. To tell us more, here is Adrian Cunhas from Jour de Gallo. Adrian, what did James Reveley say and why after he'd won the big race yesterday in France?
Hi. So just after a quite impressive victory in the equivalent of the French Grand National, the Prix du Président de la République, so this would be the stakes of the President of the French Republic, he said to the mic of the French Racing TV, well, I'm a significant taxpayer. I'm in France for 8 years, and it's such a shame that I can't have my papers done for my resident permit. So I'm calling to the French president. I just won the race that have his name for some help. So it was a bit done with some humor, I would say. But a few people posted it on social media, and it went viral. And up to the point that the next day, the French president was on the countryside on a tour, and he was alerted about this, and so James Reveley will have a rendezvous in a hurry to have this paper fixed, which he failed to have for the last 8 years. So it proved to be a very effective move, and it proved to be quite a effective choice to move, effective strategy to move the French administration, which sometimes can be a bit slow.
That's pretty extraordinary. That's certainly one way to do it. It must have been enormously frustrating. And all joking aside, for all that he now appears to have an audience with those close to the president and to get his residence permit, he's got two French-born children. He's got two French children. It must be extremely difficult for him.
Absolutely, and he, as you say, he's two kids have as a French citizenship. He owns a training yard. He's paying a lot of taxes in this country, so he's bringing things to the French economy. He has a perfect mastering of the language. His French is really good. The problem is that when you don't have this type of papers done, he doesn't have really an health care. So if he get injured, he has to pay a lot of his pocket, and some things probably he won't have access. And I think it's really hard for him to borrow money. in this type of situation. So it's a massive problem, and I'm not an expert about this, but I'm afraid it's one of the consequences. He's one of the very few British people that have been very unlucky after Brexit, because I think most of them, they had a resident permit when they asked, but a few of them, for reasons that are hard to understand, failed to have it. And when he was interviewed on national TV, because all the big French papers and also the national TV, the news channels, tried to contact him, and he was aired on big French TVs, he explained that he tried on multitent attempts to have a contact with the French administration, with emails, with letters. He did everything he could, but he didn't have an answer except his case was refused, which is completely insane, because I know around me many British citizens that are perfectly integrated in the French society, that have their resident permits, and they are in the same situation than him. So I can't see any good reason for James Strigley not having his resident permit.
All right, that was Adrian Cunhas. David Yates is with me from the Daily Mirror. A quirky story to kick off with, Dave, but one with quite serious implications, particularly for those people who are thinking of going to ride in France and thinking of making a life and career there, which plenty of people do. If you can't get yourself money lending and you can't get free healthcare, it's going to put you off pretty significantly, I would have thought.
Yeah, it certainly is. When we first read this story, it seemed like, as you say, a quirky one, but it does have serious ramifications post-Brexit, doesn't it? Two of the most fundamental things in any adult's life are the ability to borrow money, in most cases to buy a house, and also, of course, to guarantee healthcare. And those are two things that are affected by James Reevely's inability to get the titre du séjour, I hope I pronounced that correctly, the residency permit. As he pointed out, he pays more than 50,000 euro in tax every year. He's lived in France, relocating, of course, from Britain, a scion of the famous Reevely dynasty. He's lived in France since July 2016, and he has two French children who have a French mother. So his inability, particularly to get healthcare, that's the main one, isn't it? Because there are few professions more dangerous than that of a jump jockey. And so those are areas of his life that he needs to look after pretty well. And the inability to get that because of the absence of a residency permit is a serious issue. James Reevely is a big earner as a sportsman in France. And so, yeah, it looked like a quirky story, but it's actually quite an interesting one, as you say, with ramifications for those who are thinking about relocating to France. Bryony Frost was in the media a month or so ago saying that that was an area that she was exploring. And certainly for a jump jockey, it's a very attractive lifestyle for people who have spoken to James Reevely or Felix de Giles. If you can make it, then it's a very nice life there.
All right, well, come what may, this jump season still has a little bit of life in it, and mainly courtesy of the Mullins title bid, which rolls on to Sandown, of course, on Saturday. I mean, he's got it all pretty much wrapped up, but we're still going to run some good horses, some very good horses, amongst them El Fabiolo and the Celebration Chase. That was targeted from a fair way out. Anthony Bromley's racing manager to Simon Meunier and Isaac Swed, who own El Fabiolo. Anthony, has he done well since his Cheltenham mishap, do you think?
He came back a little bit sore from it all, but they're pleased with him now. And yeah, it's talking to David Casey last night, all systems go for Saturday. He'd been unbeaten over fences, and you know, when the world was his oyster, obviously there was a blip there. He's got to get round Sandown and cope with the railway fences on that quick ground. Look, it's a fair test for him, and he's not going to get an easy one. By the look of those entries, yeah, it'll be interesting.
And it sounds as though we've got game on, because Nicky Henderson, we spoke to on the podcast yesterday, I wondered whether he might take advantage of the easier opportunity at Punchestown, but no, he's all set for Sandown as well. Look at the two horses. How do you analyse their relative merit right now over 2 miles on that track?
I don't know, really. I mean, let's see. I mean, it's going to be good ground. John Bond came back to form at Aintree. Enjoyed the 2.5. Look, I mean, there's other horses in the race too. I mean, even Nubi Negra on that sort of ground, you know, if he came back to his best form, could be a danger. See, they've got Captain Guinness entered there, but you'd think he'll be going to Punchestown, wouldn't you?
Well, Henry de Bromhead's got a few entered at Sandown. Jungle Boogie's in the Oaksea Chase, and he's got one or two entered dotted around elsewhere. So we'll find out. I suppose the fly in the ointment, the real fly in the ointment, could be if you get friendly fire from Gaelic Warrior.
Don't get the impression, do you, that he's coming?
Well, we spoke to Joe on the pod yesterday, and he wasn't ruling it out, but I think, a bit like you, you have to wait until the last minute to find out, don't you?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
If he ran, would he be a big worry for you? Would he be more of a worry than John Bond?
I think that way round, I think you'd have to think so, wouldn't you, really?
I mean, he looked pretty deadly in the Arkle, didn't he?
Yeah, but I don't think you'll see them both running, do you? I mean, I haven't had that from the horse's mouth, but my gut feeling is El Fabiola runs Saturday and a Gaelic Warrior goes for the novice of Punchestown. That would be how I'd read the situation myself, but as you know, that things can change. We've got Imperi Pass going to go Saturday as well.
Yeah, and
I'm quite excited to see him over a trip and right-handed. I know he's got a penalty for his wins, but I'm quite excited about seeing him run.
Now, even though you fully know my view on the Stewards' Inquiry at Aintree, but notwithstanding that, I still think he was probably quite a long way the best, given how idle he was when he hit the front. Do you think he's always going to be showing only what he needs to show? And i.e., if the race was better still, he could perform to an even higher level?
I think so. I think we're all still learning about Imperi Pass, and Paul will definitely ride him slightly, even wait even longer with him, I suspect, come Saturday. But yeah, he surely was the best horse by a little bit, wasn't he, at Aintree? You felt he was, the way he put the race to bed. It was just an agonising last 100 yards, really. To get a big Grade 1 win out of him, it just sort of felt good in many ways, yeah. It meant it wasn't a waste of a season. He's a 160-rated hurdler. Look, that's pretty good. And he'd be an exciting chaser. But he is obviously a slight enigma, and... But you'd rather have the talent under the bonnet than not, so.
And just moving on to your wearing your other hat, you were at the Breeze Ups last week. You're heading up to Doncaster now to hopefully buy a few more horses. How are you finding trade and how are you finding the market?
It was interesting last week. There was some huge headline prices. I mean, I can't remember a sale that they you lit the touch paper on a couple of horses and they went absolutely crazy bonkers prices, I thought, but we'll still see in the fullness of time. But underneath that, I mean, I'd say Tessie and I, we vetted 7 or 8 horses. 2 of them didn't get through the vets perfectly, so we left them. And basically, we bought the 6 that passed the vet, and we found that they were buyable. The ones we aimed at, the aims we targeted, we bought. And it was quite interesting that was sort of at a range from 25 grand to 100 grand. So it was quite a range, but that's sort of what we call the sort of lower to middle market, I suppose, on the flat. And I just feeling that it isn't that deep a market underneath the top level prices. I think there were 30-odd% not sold through the ring, even after private sales, because there was more than that in the ring that were not sold, but some did get deals outside the ring. We did a couple of private sales a little bit later. But it was also an interesting, I reckon there was at least half a dozen, if not 10, were withdrawn with an hour to go in the sale, which means that they were withdrawn through lack of interest. That the vendor thought, I'm not going to get my money, I'm not putting it through with a reserve of X amount because I have to pay commission on the high reserve or whatever. If I'm not, you know, lack of interest were being pulled out. So there was a higher not sold rate than what's actually even in the paper because they were just withdrawn. But they had turned up, they'd breezed, and they weren't being withdrawn because they were late. They were withdrawn with an hour to go, lack of interest. Now, that is a sign that this game's not as deep at the moment. So I'm going at the Doncaster thinking there's some bargains to be had up here this week.
Well, enjoy. And then I presume you're going to roll on to Punchestown next week. How many runners in the double green at the big festival in Ireland next week?
Well, it slightly depends on Saturday. I mean, we've got a few other entries on Saturday at Sandown as well. But I think James de Burley and O'Castle de Mott will wait for Punchestown, although they are entered Saturday. We've got some nice horses going. Obviously, Jasmine DeVoe, go champion bumper. Another Way was a bit unlucky at Easter at Fairy House. He'll have another crack at the job. Mr. Gifts in the winners of one. Got Blizzard of Oz going for a final. Got Stuart Crawford's going for the Full Circle final. There's plenty of, yeah, I don't know, and we've got plenty in the bumpers, so probably about a dozen, I suppose, that Punchestown will run. Yeah, and the boys are over. I've got to juggle a lot of things. I've got the Guineas Breeze up, the Punchestown Goffs point-to-point sale. There's a lot of things going on at the moment.
Yeah, not to mention this two-year-old filly trained by William Haggis by Kodiak that the Double Green have got to unleash on Thursday. Is she going to run Kalipos?
He didn't think she would. The ground at the moment, it's sort of in that changing transition, so I'm not sure if he will. I wouldn't get too excited about that one. She's not another relief rally.
Can we get excited by Bance then, by the same sire? Colt.
Bance goes better than Kalipos anyway, I'll say that. So let's fingers crossed he's okay. Yeah.
Good. Okay.
They'll be their first two-year-old runners, yeah.
Fingers crossed. Anthony, thank you very much. Good luck on Saturday.
Thanks, Nick. Cheers.
All right, that was Anthony Bromley. Plenty of food for thought there. Some quite interesting comments on the health of the Breeze Up sales at the back end there. But really, we wanted to know about El Fabiello and Ampere A Pass. Looks as though James de Burley might swerve Sandown to go to Punchestown. El Fabiello versus John Bond, David Yates, how do you see it shaping up with the assumption that Gaelic Warrior is not going to be there?
Yes, it's interesting. I mean, I was actually the only person in the Racing Post tipsters box for the Queen Mother Champion Chase who took on El Fabiello, Nick. Did you know that?
Well, funnily enough, you had mentioned it, yes, but you didn't take him on with the right horse, did you?
No, indeed. Indeed. For the first part of the tipping piece, I sounded like Nostradamus in saying that El Fabiolo, one day, one of these mistakes would not be forgiven. But sadly, I put in Edward Stone as my selection instead of the captain, Captain Guinness. I'm not sure that I agree with the view that he was flawless before Cheltenham. I think that was an accident waiting to happen. And like many people, I'd be interested to see how he goes around Sandown. I think that will be a stern test. We know all about the railway fences. There are obstacles where chasers need to get in a very definite and very certain rhythm to jump those trio fences going towards the end of the back straight at Sandown. And that would be a concern. One thing that I've learned, though, I think this spring with Willie Mullins is that the way that he can work on a horse's jumping, I find really interesting, because in my time in racing, however good the trainer, when a horse finds it hard to jump fences or has an idiosyncratic technique of doing so, it's pretty hard, I think, for the trainer to change that. It does happen, but it's something where I think that if a chaser, even a very good one, has jumping frailties at the start of that career, they often endure. Now, two instances this spring, whereby Mullins horses have gone to a race with concerns over their jumping and they've come out victorious. Gaelic Warrior, I was in no doubt that horse wouldn't win the Arkle. I think I said on this podcast you couldn't back him with Sextons. Well, you and plenty of others disagreed with that, and you were proved right. And I knew my fate after the first two fences. Just thought, oh goodness, this horse hasn't jumped out to his right markedly. He's sailing around, and he won with ease, of course, a race that now looks even better than it did at the time. And also, Iron Maximus, I know that he didn't jump perfectly round Aintree to win win the Grand National, but he did it well enough. And I'm wondering with El Fabiolo whether since that mishap at Cheltenham, whether at Clissutton, they've absolutely drilled that horse's jumping. So I'll be fascinated to see how he gets on in the Celebration Chase. It's not a race really that I wish to bet on, but it's one that I will certainly watch.
All right, time for a little context, courtesy of the Timeform Perspective, and Dan Barber here to give you Willie Mullins in numbers. Dan, take it away.
Yeah, I did enjoy this because there are so many numbers that you unearth and you think, Carl, that's incredible. And then something else smacks you right between the eyes and you think, this is unparalleled. There's maybe still a world or two to conquer. We'll touch upon that, but there aren't many left. And I thought the thing that put into perspective Mullins' dominance as much as anything, we've got the total prize money, of course, that of the 50 top earning performances in the UK this season, so that could be winning the Grand National with Iron Maximus, or it could be, say, Henry de Bromhead finishing second with Manella Indo, the top 50 highest earning performances. Mullins has 14 of those, Nick, and Ireland have 28 in total, but compare that to Skelton and Nichols, who've had 3 and 2 respectively. It's obvious from the numbers that it's been big prize money races that Mullins has been scooping because he's had so few runners compared to the other two. But that really does put it into some sort of context. And the thing that struck me actually was if you take out other Irish trainers, the person who's had fewest runners who features in the top 50 of the Trainers' Championship this season, Mullins has had 144, is Harry Fry, who's down in 23, who's had 138 runners. But his earnings are 575,000. Willie Mullins' are in excess of 3 million.
That is pretty remarkable. But it is, as you say, that sheer dominance of the top races, of where the prize money opportunities are, that staggers. The only thing that surprised me almost, Dan, was having taken stock of the fact that he'd won the Grand National and the Gold Cup and the Champion Hurdle and the Scottish National and just about everything else, that he hadn't already had his hands on that Trainers' Championship sooner.
Yeah, it is remarkable, isn't it? There was definitely a greater emphasis on it this year when that chance became open to him. Credit to Matt Brocklebank, Sporting Life Timeform colleague, who flagged up in a column way ago now about the prospect of, well, he's only 500,000 behind, and if you do this and you do that and the pieces fall together, Matt was alive to it. But for it to happen, it is pretty staggering. And I think there are another few numbers that need reflected upon as well. The man who's considered his main rival in Ireland, what a season Gordon Elliott had as well, and it's been completely overshadowed. He's earned 1.6 million in total in Britain. He's had 20 winners compared to Mullins' 24. He's had fewer runners. It's been a phenomenal season to see Elliott lying fifth in the Trainers' Championship. And I think one thing to consider with Willie as well, I think it's actually a scary prospect, this one, that there are of the 40 performances, so 40 individual performances from the start of the season to the current time of talking, Nick, only 40 horses have run to a time form rating of 160 plus. But remarkably, just 7 of those are trained by Willie Mullins. And that may sound, oh, well, is he lacking these top notches? I don't think that is the case. What I think is quite scary, I think it's a reflection that he's won valuable novice races as well from horses that aren't yet achieving 160s, but are very much likely to as the season, next season wears on. So it's a frightening prospect for everyone else. Now, I've used this quote before. That great Sid Waddell used that line about when Alexander the Great was 33, he cried salt tears because there were no more worlds to conquer. Eric Bristow is only 27. There are still maybe an area. He ticked off another one yesterday. Can the next Project Mullins be a winner at every single British track? If it was 26 before Foss Lass. If he has the winner they're expecting at Ludlow, he's going to be down to 25. So come on, Willie, pull your socks up.
Dan, that's Willie Mullins. You've been transitioning this week to flat racing, courtesy of ITV's Sunday series. Something popped out at you there as well.
Yeah, very much did. There were two horses of note, actually. One was Barrack, a 2-year-old, who's probably Royal Ascot bound for Kevin Ryan. But the one who got the handicappers at time form excited was Ice Max, who's now made it 4 from 7 in his career. He very much blew hot and cold as a 2-year-old. I'm not sure what the reason for that was, but he's had two starts back this season. He handed out a four-length drubbing at Bath, clocked a time form rating of 105, and then he's at Musselburgh on Sunday, the most remarkable performance, a five-and-a-half-length thrashing of a horse trained by Mark Johnston, who was well-touted and went off favourite, and he's run to a figure of 116. Now, he's run over a mile twice this season, Nick. Wouldn't be dead sure of a Royal Ascot target, maybe a St. James's. As a gelding, there'll be races that are limited to him. That's one of the key points, but that was a monstrous performance. It was the performance of a group horse, and it's just a case of which group race they deem the most suitable opening for him for his first attempt. But he was deeply impressive, and I'd encourage anybody to watch back the last two furlongs.
All right, that's Ice Max, an eye catcher from the Sunday series, and Willie Mullins in numbers this week. In the time form perspective, Dan Barber, thank you very much. Well, we all know that Willie Mullins sent his B team to the Scottish National, no disrespect intended, and came up trumps. It looks like the C team for the Bet365 Gold Cup, he could still come up trumps because he's still got two in the first five in the betting. But Kitty's Lightheads, the market, the defending champion, fifth in the Grand National, splendid horse and winner of many such races. Can he do it again off his current mark, David Yates?
Yeah, I think he probably can. He ran a storming race in the Grand National. It was a weird one, wasn't it, Aintree, this year in terms of the ground? Because I think a few of us, certainly, you know, I have to write quite a lot of my preparation stuff the weekend before Aintree, because once the meeting starts on the Thursday, it's very hard to find time to write stuff that you haven't already done. And everyone said the reports from Aintree were, you know, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, it was absolutely lashing down. This is going to be a real sloggers Grand National. And I'm not sure it was in the end. I think that the racing surface was a lot better than many of us thought it was going to be. It was probably in between for Kitty's Light. It wasn't so bad that they thought about pulling the horse out, but certainly it wasn't dry enough for that horse to be seen at his best. Nevertheless, he finished best of the home contingent, the British runners, in fifth. When you consider that Iron Maximus won the race by 7.5 lengths, well, it was a further three to Kitty's Light, and that was an excellent effort. Remember last year, he won those three signature staying chases, the Ida Chase at Newcastle, the Scottish National at Ayr, and then came out a week later to win the Bet365 Gold Cup. He did that off 140 of a BHA rating of 140 last year. He's £5 higher this time around. So there's, crucially, what does seem to have happened with both, I know, Sandown and Kempton last night, that the ground has dried out, and so the racing surface is absolutely ideal for Kitty's Light. He's an eight-year-old. It's, for all that we've seen plenty of him, he's as good, if not better, than ever. We all know that this has been a very important story for racing over the last year or so, with the illness of Betsy, Christian Williams' daughter. And again, I'm sure that as at Aintree, we'll all be willing this horse to gain back-to-back triumphs at Sandown this weekend.
Well, we were expecting it to be another wonderful Aintree for Lucinda Russell. It wasn't really to be, with Corak Ramblers early exit in the Grand National and sadly losing Giovinco earlier on in the meeting. There were happier moments for Lucinda yesterday, David. Why?
Yeah, that's right. At Hexham, it was an emotional victory, actually. Lucinda Russell set the record for a Scottish trainer's number of wins last season with 71, and she went past that yesterday. A 72nd victory for the stable was achieved by She's Not Joe King's defeat of stablemate I Wish For You. Patrick Wudge rode the winner, so he's now, I think, 37-31, clear of Bradley Harris. It was an emotional win. That the winner is owned by the Tay Valley Chasers. They sponsored the race, and that was named in honour of Patrick Crofts, who's the late son of Nick Crofts, who's a member of the Tay Valley Chasers Syndicate. So it was obviously an important race for Connections to win, and they did so, and in doing so, they gave Lucinda Russell's stable another landmark victory, 72nd of the season, and that is the new Scottish record.
Okay, it is Tuesday, so we go around the bloodstock world with our friends at Weatherby's, their stallion book and their global stallion app. I'm really pleased for the first time in this segment that we can head to County Leash to Angrove Stud, which is now nearly 55 years in business and has been in the Pym family for six generations. Alistair Pym, you will know from his silver larynx as a Tattersall's auctioneer. But his family steeped in this business and are still getting well stuck in. Alistair, what's been the thread that has kept the Pym family so engaged and enthralled to this sport for so long?
Well, from my point of view, I was rare to it. So we've been trying to keep it going. I came back from Australia in 89, and I've been here where I worked with my father since then, since he passed away in 2010. And then I took it over, and sure, we've just trying to keep our head down and keep the ball rolling as best we can.
And if there was something that kind of characterised the way he did things, the way his parents did things, what would it be? What would be your kind of philosophy on how best to operate in this game?
Well, I mean, the game is no doubt getting tougher. I mean, there are more National Hunt Stallions now in Ireland than there ever was. So there's an awful lot of luck in it. And you just, unfortunately, the way it's gone, you need to try and cover as many mares as you can with the stallion, especially with a new horse, and try and get foals on the ground, good looking foals, and just try and keep it going that way as best you can and hope that it works out from the sales point of view.
I mean, as you correctly identify, it's a very different business in 2024 to how it was in the 50s, 60s, 70s. If there was a turning point for Angrove, if there was a point which kind of ensured its perpetuity, at least for this generation, what would it have been?
Look, it's basically getting the right stallions. I mean, we were lucky we got Alderbrook here. And I mean, basically it is about getting the right stallion as best you can to get the mares there. We were very lucky to get Alderbrook, and he was got a couple of very, very good horses. He got Cheltenham winners or whatever. And I mean, in the last couple of years, we've been lucky we got Vendangeur from France, who had a grade one winner in Aintree with Arzal before we got him. And so I mean, it's about that and trying to keep them the best horses coming as best you can, and try and keep the mares coming to them. We were lucky we got Free Eagle this year, and then actually in this stud season, we were very lucky to get the classic winner Max Sweeney.
Absolutely.
The National Stud, which is brilliant.
I want to come to those stallions that you're standing at the moment in a minute. I just go back to Alderbrook. He was an amazingly talented racehorse, winning a champion hurdle on just his third hurdle start, and really off hardly any preparation at all. When you stood him, was it an advantage or a disadvantage that he'd actually been a high-level hurdler at the time?
Oh, that is a good question. I think it was probably ended up being an advantage in the day, but he also won a Group 2 in France on the flat, which actually I think probably if he hadn't have done that, it would have been hard to get mares to him. He stood in England for three seasons, I think, with Scarlett and Robert Knight. And it's just the way it's gone now. They're more inclined to send mares to hurdle winners because those French horses seem to be to win hurdles and whatever, and they seem to cover away. But it would have been difficult back in those days if he'd only won the champion hurdle. People would have said, oh, he got too far or whatever.
But he was a rare beast. He was a brilliantly talented one, and as you say, he produced some great horses. I can't move on to the present day without a nod to Prince Regent, because he was the sire of Remittance Man, one of my favourite horses, and a real
Absolutely.
Talent. When people talk about the modern greats, he's often rather overlooked, I think.
Totally, absolutely, yeah, very much. And your remittance man kept his name in the lights at the time. And God, no, he was some chaser, remittance man. Yeah.
So when you go out to try and get a stallion now clearly you have to cut your cloth. The competition's enormous, as you were suggesting. I mean, Coolmore have got dozens of lovely National Hunt stallions now, and Rathbarry and everybody else.
Yeah.
How do you go about getting that little diamond in the rough?
You need to do a lot of homework before the horse season even comes to market, and try and get your foot in the door even before it comes to market. And that is probably the main thing. If you have a couple of bloodstock agents working for you on your behalf from that point of view, and keeping their eyes open for what they think might be a National Hunt horse down the line, I think probably that is the way. But then there again, money is your big talking point. You can't be spending too much money on National Hunt horses, because there's no guarantee you're going to get it back.
So we all know that Jim Bolger has massive faith in the horses that he's bred and then head off to stud. How excited are you about McSweeney, and what does he offer you, you think, that's really going to appeal to breeders?
Well, I think looking at the individual, he's a mighty horse. He's 16.3 plus. He's a wonderful athletic walk. He's very correct. I don't think anybody would come into the yard and criticise him as an individual standing up in front of you. I mean, he was tough when he won his guineas. He really toughed it out on softish ground. So he did everything he was asked to do at the time. He was a winning group one winning 2-year-old as well. And the great thing about Jim Bolger still having a share in the horse is that he's sending 20 to 25 mares to him, which will be a big advantage as they come to start racing either two or three-year-olds. Like, if he comes up with a half decent horse and they happen to go running a juvenile hurdle, it'll make a big difference rather than waiting till they're 5 or 6 till they get to a point.
And is the roster as a whole, has it got the sort of balance that you want?
I think so, yeah. It's always tough. Look, we're always looking for what we think is the right horse. It's got more difficult to start off a new sire, because all the breeders are looking for the proven horse, and they're the ones that are making their name in the sales ring. It's got very polarized in the sales ring in the last few years. So everybody's looking for the horse that's already popular and getting winners. So it's got more difficult to start a horse from the track. For a small stud like our own,
and maybe on not quite such a tangible level, what is it about the game now? For all the acknowledged difficulties and getting into a competitive market, what is it about the game that makes you get out of bed with a spring in your step every morning?
Well, look, I mean, it's certainly not from the money point of view, but I mean, I love the stud work. Love covering mares. We do all our own foalings here. We foal about 40, 50 mares a year. And I love the veterinary bit of the work. I mean, the most enjoyable part of my work that I find most enjoyable is getting difficult mares in foal. Love that point of view. So, I mean, it's just, look, it's a way of life. And unfortunately, I'm stuck in it. But you mightn't be making a whole lot of money in it, but sure, I love it. Every day you can get out of bed is a good day.
Alistair, thanks for talking to us. All the very best for the next season.
Okay, thank you very much, Nick.
All right, thanks to all my guests today. David Yates is still with me. David, before we go, you've been desperate to tell me about a dream you had last night. I'm quite worried about where this is going.
Yeah, there's nothing to be worried about, Nick. It was just a dream I had a couple of nights ago, and it was after the Scottish National, and it was that Willie Mullins sends over his C and D listers on regulation Saturdays, not necessarily the grade ones, which he'll probably win anyway, but he just mops up the feature races every Saturday. He doesn't travel to Britain because he's got high-profile runners in Ireland, and the Sunday Mirror, my desk, are asking me for 800 words and there's nobody to talk to. I just wondered to what extent that this spring might inform the master of Clissutton that there are prizes to be won here, perhaps with horses owned by English people, and that maybe he might venture here a bit more often on Saturdays and mop up more of our domestic prizes.
Well, it did strike me, and it was suggested by Patrick in an interview yesterday, wasn't it, at Foss Last, that, you know, if he wins on Saturday, when he wins on Saturday, it'll just encourage him to do it over and over again, which I would imagine it probably will. And if you've got that many horses, then why not? I wondered about the possibility of a satellite yard.
Yeah, well, they've got enough horses to do that. I wasn't sure whether Patrick Mullins was being serious when he said that, but you just never know, do you? Because we've made mention many times over the last couple of weeks about how the Mullins B, C, D list as well. You know, when he trains a 1, 2, 3, 4 in a Grade One race at Cheltenham, well, the fact that the first three don't run in the next Grade One and he relies on number four, that is still the best horse running in that race, isn't it? And so, yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, you know, how old is Willie Mullins now? Is he 67, isn't he? But he continues over the last 5 years or so, just continues to set new records, break new boundaries, etc. So yeah, it's an interesting one. I thought it was quite I thought it was a bad dream, I must say. That's not an anti-Mullins sentiment, but just the thought that horses from Carlo could come over and win our big races every weekend, and it's almost an afterthought, given that it's not the prime focus of the trainer for that weekend. But we will see.
All right, David, thank you so much. What have you got a tip for me for today?
I have indeed. We go to Epsom, who start their flat season today with the historic Great Metropolitan Handicap, a race that dates back to the 19th century. It's due off at 3:55 today, and the selection is Champagne Piaf, off for a good while before that return to action third at Bath earlier this month, and I hope can build on that for a second course victory. 3:55 race at Epsom, selection number 6, Champagne PF for Gary and Ryan Moore.
Yep, currently trading around about the 5-2 mark, Champagne PF for the Weatherby's Global Stallions app, Great Metropolitan Handicap. David, thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening. Tom will be with you tomorrow, and I will pick you up in Hong Kong on Thursday. We'll see you then. Take care.
You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you by Timeform, the trusted source of racing data and analysis, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by the racing app in partnership with FitStairs.